Enterprise Linux Security is brought to you by TuxCare, a company that helps you modernize your Linux security. Definitely check out TuxCare to see how they can help you automate Linux patching while minimizing downtime, staying compliant, and ensuring business continuity. Check them out at TuxCare.com. Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to Enterprise Linux Security, episode 102. I'm here with my good friend, as always, Zhao. How you doing?
All good, Jay. As always, a pleasure being here with you. And yeah, today we have another round of interesting stories that popped up during the last week. Remember the past two episodes when we talked about things that were discussed and implemented in the US and then spread all over the world because the market was just so large? This week we actually have something that goes the other way around. The EU also wants a pie of those changes that affect worldwide, so we're coming up with the Cybersecurity Act, and it's going to affect everybody, like GDPR.
Yep, and what we're going to call, or what we're going to talk about, is the Cybersecurity Resilience Act. That's kind of a tongue twister. I have no idea why, when you look at the words, it doesn't look that hard, right? Cybersecurity Resilience Act. Okay, yeah. So that's one of the stories we'll be talking about. And then CISA's in the news pretty much every episode. This one's a shorter story, though. I'm not going to spend too much time on it. We'll talk about they're making the case that writing with C and C++ and other memory unsafe languages is, well, unsafe. Stop doing it, is what they say. We'll talk about that. And a little bit of behind the scenes when it comes to info stealing malware, one of the vectors that we've talked about in the past. We'll talk about the other side of that, not the victims this side this time, although, yeah, there's a victim here, hot topic in particular, but we'll talk about what happens behind the scenes a little bit. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, so let's take this from the top and start with the Cybersecurity Resilience Act. Again, really big mouthful there. We won't bore you with the complete details of the law. It's, as you can imagine, something with this pompous name has a really long wall of text that comes with it. But so far, and by the way, this has been officially published, so I don't know if it starts immediately today, if there is a 10-day delay here before it actually goes into effect, but this is the rule of the law of the land right now. Products coming out with some form of intelligence, whether they are software, hardware, or I don't know, your home appliance that you can connect to the internet or something like that. This will touch on all of those things. And at face value, from most of what I've already read about it, and again, this is pretty long, so I might have missed something, this seems to be pretty consumer-friendly in a way that's surprising. And it touches on stuff that we keep mentioning, that it's just common sense and some ideas that are just common sense regarding cybersecurity and connected devices. But it puts some teeth behind it. And if this is actually properly implemented and there's some agencies behind it actually enforcing the application of this, then yeah, this could be, I don't know, the momentum that gets companies actually looking at cybersecurity and their products in a different light and actually start applying it properly.
I prefer companies to do the right thing rather than policy to make them do the right thing, but we've been waiting a long time. And I think that's something that kind of annoys me. I mean, I think consumers should be a lot more angry than they are. You know, for example, we talked about this before we hit the record button. You know, in today's day and age, you could buy a brand new Android phone. You can go to the cell phone store. What do I buy? Person recommends this Android phone, newest model of whatever it is. And because it's late enough in the model's life, you get 1 year security updates and that's it. And they just pull the plug and they don't always tell you. I mean, the updates just kind of stop coming. And you know, when it comes to Android, depending on which handset provider you get your Android phone from, you might not even have this problem. You might have a great provider that does keep it up to date, but some of them don't. And this inconsistency is frustrating as consumers. You know, at least I can understand not having the latest operating system after a certain point. But if there's a security patch that's required and the phone is still being sold or it's, you know, in a supported window, I want that security patch. And obviously, like I said, we want companies to do the right thing, but it's getting increasingly hard to wait for this. We still have password issues in 2024, despite the fact we've been, you know, mentioning password strength is important the entirety of the podcast, and it's been talked to death even before the podcast. It's still a problem. Updates aren't being installed on a regular basis at average companies. It's still a problem. It hasn't gotten any better. In fact, it's getting worse. So it's there's definitely going to be an aspect of this, you know, on the counter side of things and the side effects that might come about from this and the asterisks and gray areas and quirks and things that come with policy. But what else can we do? You know, and I don't really have an answer for that.
Yeah, this is always a topic that has good arguments on both sides of the equation. But so far, like you said, we've been waiting for years for companies to get their act together and start doing what they need to be doing. And every other week, there's this major breach happening in healthcare, in whatever, and people are getting hurt by this. And yeah, it's good to see some legislation that actually enforces this and gives some strength to the notion that you need to take cybersecurity seriously. If you're coming to market with new products, those products need to be secure or need to have good measures in place to be updated and all of that. And the Cybersecurity Resilience Act actually has provisions in play to do just that. One thing that is mentioned in the main text of this act is that let me rephrase this. They actually talk about, and I want to use the exact wording, that they have products with digital elements, meaning that it can be software, it can be hardware, it can be non-IT related hardware, like I said, as long as it has some type of computing installed inside. Those things have to be designed with cybersecurity first and with cybersecurity in mind. It can't just be an afterthought that after they created the product, now we need to find a way to secure what we created. That doesn't work, and that will not work under this type of legislation. The reason that we brought this up, and the reason why this is important, even if you're not in the EU and you're not covered by this act directly, is that just as for the US, because it's such a large market, manufacturers won't create two versions of the product, one for the US and one for the rest of the world. They'll just ship one version worldwide. The same thing will happen here. The EU market is also very large, and when this type of regulation starts to apply to anything sold inside the EU, it will inevitably trickle down to everything sold worldwide. Just like GDPR, and I'm sure that people who are not in the EU have already seen GDPR prompts and are tired of clicking them away and all of that, but it's because of the same principle, and it's why this act is now going to be affecting everybody. With that said, one of the provisions that's in the main body here is regards open source components. When companies ship products that include some open source components, they will inherently gain some type of responsibility for that component that they add. So they can't just willy-nilly start including stuff just because it meets their needs. They now have to consider all the risks that come with adding that. They need to make sure that what they are adding, they can track vulnerabilities in it, they can respond to those vulnerabilities, and they can deploy patches to their product if the open source component is found to be vulnerable. That's a big plus in the open source space.
Yep.
Because we're going to see more contributions and we're going to see more fixes being contributed by companies because it affects their products directly. Everybody is using open source components today, so it's good to know that companies are now more encouraged to actually provide back fixes for issues that might appear.
So just for a clarification to make it really simple, what is and is not impacted by this? So if a component is sold for profit and it has network connectivity, it's affected by this. So, and the reason why I bring that up is because we're going to have a number of people within our audience that makes something on GitHub and it's not for profit. It could be a library you're developing. It could be an image editor. I have no idea what you guys are up to, but I'm sure more than a few of you have projects out there that you're working on. If you're not charging money for it, then it's not really applicable to this. If you're charging money for it and has no network connectivity whatsoever, it's a little bit of a gray area, because if it's being installed on a computer that has, you know, connectivity, but if you think of a boot utility, I would suspect not. But, you know, it's important to keep this in mind, because right now, you know, companies need to take this into effect right now. And, oh, the other thing is, if your component is not being sold for profit, but it's being included in a product that is being sold for profit, then the security of that component needs to be taken under consideration by the product. That means if I'm developing something and I'm using this free library that anyone can download, that library doesn't have to have a filing, but I have to have a filing for my product, which includes that library, and I have to certify that everything I include in my product is, as far as I know, free of security issues. And what they can do, what a company or developer can do, is they can self-certify, or they can have a third-party provider certify it for them. So that's what the world kind of looks like with this in place.
So there's a lot of general considerations around cybersecurity and how you need to focus on, and you need to embed security by design, and you need to run risk assessments on your products and vulnerability disclosure and all of that. But there is one aspect of the act that I want to focus specifically in, which is more actionable, which is the first annex here, which describes a series of things that actually affect directly and are actually actionable by a company. For example, when you're selling a product, it has to be made available to the market without known exploitable vulnerabilities. This is pretty significant. It's just the first of many considerations that are made here, but it cannot be shipped if it has known exploitable vulnerabilities. If you think of a product that runs, for example, Linux, that's going to mean that you need to run the absolutely latest version of Linux that's available at the time of launch, because there are vulnerabilities on every version and they're constantly being fixed. So that right there touches on thousands of things that are being sold right now that run Linux under the covers that will need to ship with the latest Linux kernel, for example, or the latest Linux utility versions that they ship with. It can't just run a version from 10 years ago and call it a day. It has to be on top of the vulnerabilities that are found for the versions that they ship. And the safest route there is always shipping the latest version.
So are rolling distros going to get more popular now?
Yeah, depending on the actual update process that comes with them.
I mean, Steam is basically showing people how it's done right now with Arch Linux. And that's an aside, but I mean, if everyone wants the latest everything, there's a really good way of getting it. Not sure, depending on your project, if you actually would want it that bleeding edge, but yeah, that's something.
The second consideration that is here, and this is really important, it has to be made available on the market with a secure by default configuration. This is really important stuff. Consider, for example, OpenSSH. You get OpenSSH on any Linux distribution installation, and it comes with password login enabled by default. That's no longer considered secure today. That's the reason why when you deploy a new box out of the box, it will immediately be scanned and found if it's running an exposed to the internet, and it will start being hammered with login attempts. Coming by default with a secure configuration might mean that you need to ship with SSH keys preloaded or something like that, and password login disabled immediately. It's a typical scenario right now that when you're deploying Linux systems on an enterprise environment, whatever script you're using to roll the machines and to get them online will make those changes upon the first boot. Right now, this has to come by default. And that's really, really nice to have this mandated.
It is. I wonder, though, because SSH is disabled by default on most distributions, so I would think this would probably look like you install OpenSSH, and almost everybody's going to, because that's how we manage systems nowadays. I mean, come on. You enable it, and then normally the way it is now, you enable it, and then password authentication is enabled by default. But now, just like you said, you can enable it, turn it on, you're just going to get an access denied message. You have to have your key preloaded. Now, Ubuntu, interestingly, does this already in Ubuntu Server, where when you go to install it, just the ISO, I'm not even talking about the cloud version, just downloading Ubuntu server from their website, there's a section on there where you can add your public key during installation, which I thought was pretty cool. And you could put a URL to the public key for it to be downloaded, because, I mean, come on, you can't type all those characters. But I think, you know, I thought of it as a convenience then, but I think in light of what you just said, it's kind of what I bet a lot of distributions are probably going to end up doing.
When you're cutting corners, developing a product and rushing it to market, these type of considerations are not taken into account. First, because it's not obvious. If it doesn't come that way by default, you'll just deploy whatever operating system you want to deploy, and then you don't go through the motions and fix everything and remove password authentication and all of that, maybe if somebody points it out to you. But it takes know-how. It takes time, and it takes the ability to do the change and do it effectively. So, and I'm looking at low-cost products right now. It's not done. And those products are still being sold, and they are being widely distributed because they are low cost, so everybody can get one. I'm thinking especially about set-top boxes that run Android or run whatever, and they come with massive flaws and very old software on them. That can no longer happen under this, or these companies will face heavy penalties. So all in all, these are good propositions that come with this act. Another one, and is that vulnerabilities can be addressed through security updates, including having automatic updates turned on, but with an easy opt-out. So Microsoft, you're going to be hurt by this. and on this issue of the automatic updates, there is also a different aspect to this, is that security updates should be separate from functionality updates. And this is especially important because one of the reasons why people sometimes delay updating software is that they expect the new versions to break existing functionality, either because they deprecate behavior or they introduce stuff done in a different way than it's being expected. So it will break stuff. And this is the main reason why people delay people. And when I say people here, I mean companies and organizations and everybody will delay updating software because they are afraid of the breaking changes that those upgrades might bring. If you separate security updates from functionality updates and you make this mandatory, you can opt to receive the security updates knowing that it won't break whatever you're updating. And that's a game changer. That's one of the reasons why we at TechScare still support older languages and PHP 5, and we provide security updates for it and for Python 2.7 so that you can keep running your old software with security updates. So we already have products to do this. It's really nice to see this put into law and make it mandatory, because first it validates what we do, but that's not the main reason. Obviously, it's that it's more convenient for whoever is trying to get the security updates to actually receive them separate from the rest.
Yeah, that's a really important point. It's incredible. Like I said, we're still having this conversation about updates, but I wonder if this law will make companies test their updates better, because I almost feel like a lot of the stigma about updating things is because something wasn't tested or they didn't think of something, and then a certain subset of people have that something going on, and then next thing you know, the software is crashing, and then by the time that happens a third time, they don't want to update anything ever again.
Tell me about CrowdStrike without telling me it's CrowdStrike, right?
Well, that too. Yeah, definitely that too. Right.
Okay, so another interesting thing here. The products must ensure protection from unauthorized access through appropriate controls, authentication, identity or access management, and report possible unauthorized access. This is important because it affects stuff like your refrigerator, which might have a limited UI and the limited user interaction aspect to it, and it still has to report that it has been tried, that somebody tried to break into it somehow. So it will also touch on the way that we look at UIs and security alerts on devices, even when they are not designed right now to account for that. So it's interesting to see that those devices will need different UI elements to show it.
So I get an alert every time if the fridge is open. That sounds great if you have teenagers.
You'll also get an alert if somebody from the internet is trying to log into your refrigerator. So there's that.
Wow.
another thing.
I guess the fridge would have Langerhans disease. Sorry. Anyway, ask. Okay.
So this one is interesting, especially since a few months back we talked about the proposed legislation, also in the EU, that was then pulled and was not voted on, where they wanted to include mandatory backdoors. So right now they are saying that the devices must protect the confidentiality of stored, transmitted or processed data, personal or otherwise, by encrypting the relevant data at rest, in transit, with state-of-the-art mechanisms. Meaning that state-of-the-art mechanisms do not include backdoors. So it's really nice that this is put into law.
That is really amazing, actually. Because that's the first thing when I first became aware of this. I before I read it, I was like, oh no, they're trying to get a backdoor in. Because every time I see one of these government stories about security, it seems like it's that. But I was actually surprised with what I read instead when I looked through the article.
Yeah. Another thing, and they're trying to enforce changes here, and this one I don't know how they're going to be able to actually enforce this, but the devices will have to be able to operate even if they have been the subject of an exploit or an attempted exploit. So there has to be some type of resilience to the device, and this touches on the title of the act, Cybersecurity Resilience Act, where the devices don't just have to have measures in play to prevent the attacks, but when they suffer those attacks, they still need to operate in some fashion. And the closest analogy I can see here is actually on the US law that you have with the FCC, with stuff that it comes on every device. They must not emit radio interference, but they must operate when they have radio interference themselves. And this came as a notice in every single electronic device in the past few decades, at least. So that's the closest analogy I can see here. The devices must be able to resist being exploited and still operate in some fashion. And that's interesting to see how they'll be able to pull this off.
Especially considering when a device has been compromised, the first thing that happens is you can't touch anything on the screen. Like if it's a phone, you can't tap on anything, none of the icons work, you have a full screen, you know, your computer has been a ransomware message that comes up. The first thing threat actors try to do is stop you from using devices, so they're going to have to probably have the core functionality of the device separate from the, you know, what's facing the internet, I would think.
Probably some heavy sandboxing techniques employed as well.
Yeah, I would think so.
Really, really interesting about seeing how that gets put into practice. The device needs to provide security-related information by recording and monitoring relevant activity on the device with an opt-out mechanism for the user. So starting to read this point, you might think that, oh, this is just surveillance that comes built into the device, but the user has the ability to turn it off. And that, again, like the other one that prevents the backdoor stuff, this one is also pretty relevant, knowing what we know of how these things operate. Having something that logged all the activity on the device and not being able to turn it off, that's an Orwellian stuff that we really don't need. It's good to see that it comes in the same sentence. They say that it has to be opted out by the user. It can be opted out by the user. And the latest point that I need to bring to light here, because it's really, really interesting here, is that users need to have the ability to completely and securely wipe the device, removing all settings, all data that they have there, and they have to be given the ability to migrate to another device in a secure manner. What you can get from out of this is that you can get your data from an Android phone to an iPhone and vice versa, and the makers of those devices can't introduce barriers in the middle and that oppose your operation there. That's really different from the walled gardens that you have right now.
Yeah, my fiance and I just ran into this. It's horrible, the fact that, you know, there's nothing, no incentive for a phone manufacturer to make it easy for you to take your settings out of that phone to a competing phone. So most don't do this. So we ran into this switching phones recently, and then photos are in the wrong order because they're in one photo app and they don't have the metadata the same way when they transfer over. So then the order of the photos get jumbled up, and then It'd be nice to see something happen to where people could be more portable, because I think that's what people want.
It will be nice to see how companies respond to this and try not to be maliciously compliant with these requirements.
Maliciously compliant. That should be a t-shirt. Anyway.
And see how they avoid that, because that's going to be their first drive. We're going to do the absolute worst experience possible for end users and companies that are using our products, so that we sidestep everything on this regulation. But like I said at the start, this is surprisingly good. At least the way that it's written on paper, and however it's enforced, it might be a different thing, but it's surprisingly user-friendly, and it's different from many of the laws and proposals that we've seen in the past, and really, really interesting to see how this plays out. It will also touch on stuff like software bill of materials, because when you're producing your product, you need to create a software bill of materials that comes with it. You, at the very least, it must include the first order includes of your product, meaning that the libraries that you use directly, the frameworks, the whatever secondary product programs that you're calling, all of those need to be part of the SBOM. Like I said, really, really good steps in the right direction. If companies can't get their act clean and can't act on their own, it's really nice to see that at least some effort is being done in getting them to act properly.
Yep, and compliance is expected by 2027. So that's my understanding of when, like the end of 2027, like December of 2027. So that's how long you have, from what I understand.
Yeah, but there are some things in it that start to apply immediately. So it might be interesting if you're in a company that develops products with some type of intelligence or provides services that might be affected. This might be your nighttime reading here. So yeah, take a look at this. This will affect you regardless of your being in the EU or not. As long as your products are sold in the EU or are somehow reachable or accessible to people in the EU, you will be covered by this. So yeah.
Yep. All right, so we'll have a link to that story in the description. Actually, we already do. We have the link to the document you can read. So if you want to learn more about it, you certainly can do that from that article. So do we want to talk about memory unsafe apps now? This is such a weird word to say. Memory unsafe. Your app is memory unsafe. Like, does it keep forgetting its memory? No, it's not what we mean. So basically, this is different in the first story because this is not law. This is RFC. It's request for comments. It's time to write in and, you know, if you have opinions about this to the legal people and voice your opinion. But basically, it's a strong suggestion to stop using memory unsafe languages. Okay, so we think of languages like C and C++. And essentially what that means is that developers using one of those memory unsafe languages, they have to, of and by themselves, make sure that things aren't jumping the track, so to speak. So if you think of use after free types of exploits that could be impacted by this. And developers need to, do their due diligence to make sure that those types of things aren't possible. For example, if you have the user input text into a text field, maybe you should cap that the count of characters to a certain number so they don't, paste in an entire SQL command and have it be executed. So basically what they're suggesting is memory safe languages like Rust, Java, C#, Go, Python, and Swift. And I'm taking that from the article that we have linked. And in those languages, and I'm not primarily a developer, but in those languages, memory management happens by the language itself. But the trade-off is that the application isn't going to run quite as fast as an app that's compiled, with C or C++. Now, go ahead.
That's the usual talking point that developers use when they want to. Yeah, I'm using C++ to get the most of my hardware, or I'm using C because I need to go low level and touch on everything and be as fast as possible on this device. It's just on very specific edge cases that the change is actually noticeable. And it's actually on just specific edge cases. that you likely won't see in your day-to-day activity. The software that you might be writing does not need to run at the fastest possible speed on current generation equipment that like we have today, because it makes no difference if it takes 2 nanoseconds more or less. It really doesn't. You're not writing software to control, I don't know, you might be, but you're not trading on the stock exchange and where that difference might make you more money or less money. But most times, developers that come with that argument just want to sound smarter than they actually are, and they're not actually writing software that actually makes use of that. If the language that you're writing your code in, if the developer is responsible for allocating and freeing memory, then that's a memory and safe language. They use C and C++. They are not the only situation. People might still write code in assembly if they're maniacs. But anyhow, they recommend languages that do the memory management at the language level, not at the developer level, because humans really suck at writing code. And I know that's not a very good sentiment to have, but we really, really suck at writing code, and we write perfect bugs every time. So any incentive that we might have into writing in languages that actually protect us from making those types of mistakes, and every single week we know about new exploits and new vulnerabilities that come up because somebody didn't check for a buffer overflow, like you said, somebody just took whatever was inputted and wrote it to the buffer, and it went past the end of the buffer and overwrote something else at a different memory location. Those types of things don't happen when the language itself is protecting the developer. It's not that the code will be inevitably or even measurably slower in most scenarios. It really isn't, and you'll be hard-pressed to find real-world examples of where that applies. But people like writing code in C. People like writing code in C++. Like people like to write code in whatever language they're most comfortable with.
If
you've been writing code in C for 20, 30, 40 years even, then you know C in and out. And you probably won't be making these types of mistakes, but you're not the intended audience for this recommendation. If you're writing code for 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, you're very likely still making these types of mistakes. It's really hard to get away from them. Everybody makes mistakes. We all suck at writing code in different ways. It's just the familiarity that you get with a specific language will make you like that language very much. It's like distribution fanboys. I really like Ubuntu. I really like Red Hat. I really like CentOS. I really like Fedora. And I hate all the others because all the others suck and are really bad. They're not. They're hardly any different at all if you really look under the hood. And I know, unpopular opinion again.
Yeah, no, I agree so far.
With development languages, it goes the same route. I really like C++ and all the other languages suck and they are really slow and do everything wrong and they don't know what they're doing. Of course they do. That's why they're being used by millions of people out there. Java is the most widely used language out there. C# is a great language that has been developed from Microsoft and has been used by countless development teams all over the world. C is great and has been powering the Linux kernel for decades now. All the languages have their developers, all the languages have people that really are really good at writing code in them, and they have lots of people that are really bad at writing code in them. Yeah. Protecting yourself from making these types of mistakes is not necessarily a diss on the language. It's not because the language itself sucks. It's because it's better to not fall into the same pitfalls and go on the same holes that everybody else has fallen into before, and the language can protect you from making those mistakes.
It's funny, when you have something that imposes change, then there's, you know, obviously arguments against it, sometimes good ones, and sometimes, like you said, it just kind of feels like they're arguing against the change and using whatever ammo they have access. And it sounds great on paper, but apps will run slower. And then upper management hears that, oh, we don't want apps to run slower because then our customers will complain, but how much slower? It's similar to people that complain about Flatpak saying that they waste space when, what, you wasted 10 or 20 megabytes extra because it's a Flatpak and that really wastes that much space on your hard drive. Give me a break. Meanwhile, you know, we have 500 gigabyte SSDs for $20 on Amazon, and the people that complain probably have 2 gigs of wasted space in their log files. But, you know, here we are, you know, with complaints against change. But I get it. It's hard to, and this is the biggest problem with this, is hard to change, especially if you're forced into it. Now, what I mean is, if you've been developing something for 20 years in a particular language, and let's just say you're doing a great job, well, that's great. And now if you're required to change it to another language, I mean, you have to redo 20 years of work. Companies would have to, if something like this passed and it required things to change, then that would be, the article claims, a massive undertaking. No, I think it's an impossible undertaking. I mean, I don't think it's going to be very easy to redo the entire Linux kernel in Rust. I mean, come on. That the amount of work that would, it's doing work over. It's solving problems that have already been solved, you know. And now the article claims the whole point is, yeah, there's a lot of problems to solve. But the benefits, according to CISA, which is where this is coming from, I can't believe I didn't mention that. Their requirements are coming straight from them, and it just doesn't seem to accurately capture just how much of an undertaking. But again, they make the claim that the benefits outweigh it, because then after you do make the change, then you'll have fewer issues in your software going forward, and that's kind of where they're coming from.
Again, the goal has merit. Getting software written in safer languages has merit, because we know of all the bugs that have come public and have been exploited, and the way that software has been abused in the past is mostly exploiting these types of bugs. That said, the way that companies look at this, like you said, is that this is wasting resources. This is wasting time, wasting money, wasting good developer time. And that's very expensive. And you're basically spinning your wheels without moving from the same spot. You're always going to be with... You have a product. You have the Linux kernel, which works fine right now in 99.99% of the situations. You have the Linux kernel. Has millions of lines of code. If you need to write it in a different language, that's an undertaking that's going to take you decades to do, probably as long as it took to get to this point right now. And you'll probably reintroduce new bugs along the way, not memory related, but other bugs that happen when you're doing the translation to a different language.
Presumably side channel attacks, one service being able to impact another one. Yeah, it's not a memory issue, but if someone has, you know, a really egregious problem in one library being used by another, then that's a domino effect.
But you're wasting lots and lots of money, and companies really dislike that. The line must go up, and if the line doesn't go up, then that's a problem. And if we just wasted half our budget updating all the software that we built in-house, then that's money that doesn't go into the shareholders, and that's a problem. So the way that the market stands right now, the goal has merit. It will never see the light of day. It will never be implemented the way that they intended, because the incentive isn't there. Companies will rather deal with the fallout to having security issues on their software than doing the migration right now. Like I said before, one of the reasons that we at TechScare have support that extends the lifetime of older language versions is precisely because companies have problems updating software that they wrote 10 years ago and that needs major overhauls when they're going for a newer version language or a different language altogether, and the benefits just aren't there. You're wasting money without seeing the benefits. When the effort is done, when all the money is spent and all the time is wasted doing the conversion, you'll be at exactly the same place you were when you started, with the same program running exactly as it was before, with no improvements, just in a different language. And that's not noticeable. That's not something that you can extract value from immediately. So that's not something that companies will immediately run to.
Yep. They're saying in the article, 55% of surveyed projects use a memory unsafe language, and memory safety vulnerabilities account for 70% of vulnerabilities. So that's kind of why they're shining the light on this. I'll tell you what I am okay with. I'm okay with recommending memory-safe languages. I don't think there's anything wrong with making a recommendation. You know, they can do that. Anyone can do that. But at the same time, I would say that it's not okay to mandate it, but I won't even say that because it's not possible to mandate it. I mean, the amount of work, it's like asking somebody to complete their Steam library. Do you really think that's possible? Do you really think that's ever going to happen? Probably not. Let's be honest. You might be able to just, you know, convert a few different apps or a few different libraries, but you're, I mean, come on, redoing, like you said, decades of work. I mean, unless someone has an egregious amount of time on their hands, I just don't see it.
On the flip side, if you're taking on new projects, if you're starting new application development, then there's absolutely no reason to do it in a memory and safe language when you have better options available. When you have languages that provide you the facility of not falling into the same mistakes that you did with the other language, by all means, take that. If you're starting from scratch, then there's no wasted effort. It's just a good idea to start with a memory safe language. Regardless of all the performance, again, you're hard-pressed to find real-world examples of where places where that actually matters. There might be, there just won't be enough to justify it, the wide adoption that it has. There is one silver lining to all of this. The way that we're seeing AI evolve right now, and the current language models, and the way that coding assistant technology is being improved by the AI companies right now, we might reach a point next year, 2 years, 3 years down the line, where you might get AI to help you and do the translation from one language to another in a way that doesn't involve wasting as much time and effort and money on the actual operation. It might be feasible then to ask an AI assistant or an AI task or whatever type of AI thing we have at the time to actually do the translation then. As long as that doesn't mean that you'll be wasting developers' time and money on it, then that might be doable then. Right now, I don't see this as happening.
Does the AI assistant get a code review?
By another AI assistant.
Oh, boy. Because the only thing I worry about is... Down. Yeah, it really does. Because it's hard to... I mean, AI is great. It's just, as we all know, it has some wrinkles. So it's like... You know, I tried to have it generate an image with the word Linux in it, and it just could not spell the word Linux correctly, no matter how hard I tried. Like, and I even put it in double quotes, and I even told it, it's, you know, spell it exactly like this, letter for letter. And I put the letters, and then it was like L-I-I-N-I-X. I'm like, really? Did you not read the... So we have a little bit to go, but I agree. I mean, something like that would be feasible, but we, like you said, need more years to... kind of develop that and, you know, make it more accurate so it could actually spell things correctly.
And actually last year when this bubble started to inflate, it might seem that it would come sooner.
Yeah, like AI, please redevelop yourself better. AI, please redevelop yourself better. Just say that over and over again and see what you come up with. Okay, that's a scary movie level kind of thing right there. So another story, I'm not going to touch or read the entire thing because I think part of it is just important to read it for yourself. I wanted to shine some light on this because we talk about what happens to companies and users all the time, but we don't always, I mean, we have many times, but we don't always talk about what goes on behind the scenes. A lot of people are surprised when they find out that malware threat and threat actors, that's an economy, that's a business. You know, there's people that work for a company with HR and a president and a reporting structure and org chart, and it's a criminal company that, you know, employs threat actors. They exist. So in particular, at the nature of this article from Wired, which is linked in the description, it's titled "Inside the Massive Crime Industry That's Hacking Billion-Dollar Companies." And they're talking about a recent hack at Hot Topic. So I think it was 350 million, I believe. A large number of customers had their data basically taken over. And it was info-stealing malware that was responsible for this. They were able to get the keys to the kingdom from a developer for Hot Topic. So once that happens, and we hear about this also quite often, where API keys or passwords from a privileged account is leaked out, and that's, you know, the crown jewels that a threat actor wants more than anything else. The administrator password, it doesn't get any better than that, because even if, as the administrator, if you don't have access to someone's account, you can grant yourself access to someone's account. So it's basically everything they could ever want. And in the article, they're talking to the alleged hacker, Dark X, which sounds like a fitting name if maybe they shop at Hot Topic because they're into dark gothic type things. No judgment. Lacuna Coil is my favorite band. Anyway, when they talk about what goes on behind the scenes, so effectively you have different tools that you can, if you're a threat actor and a bad guy, you can go with one of these info stealing tools. Like they name some of them in the article, such as Nexus, Aurora, Meta, Raccoon, Redline being the most prominent one. So, and it even says in the article that these softwares, they welcome beginner or expert hackers alike, as if it's not only an industry, it's also a hobby, apparently. Because, oh, if you're just a, you know, think about getting into it, use this one if you're serious. It's almost like you're going to a car show or a car, use car lot. Oh, if you want this car or you want that car, we want this info stealing malware, you want this one, whatever one you want will best fit what you're trying to do. Some other facts about this, Telegram, and I think a lot of us already know this, is used for a lot of the dark web type things, at least according to the article. But they were alleging that they have Telegram bots that are set up to facilitate the buying of data that's stolen from these, from this malware. So I encourage everyone to read this because it's a lot of fun. Again, it's in the article. You can get a lot more information. I don't want to spoil too much of it. But the only other thing I'll say about it that was, I thought was kind of funny, is that they seem to be at war with Chrome. The article talks about a recent update that made it a lot harder for them. So, and this is about the economy, like I mentioned. So now they had to charge more money for their info stealing malware to help curb the extra development costs of going against Google's new update. So there's this back and forth war kind of thing, even going as far as to, in the code, I'm not making this up, Chrome F new cookies with the F expletive spelled out. And that's literally a camel case. It's right in the code. Chrome F new cookies is right there. So even in the code, you can see that they get frustrated when companies try to go against what they're trying to do. And then they have to get people. It's crazy. You got to read this one.
Yeah, this is an example of something that we've talked in the past about the economy of malware. And the many amounts of millions of dollars that go into this economy. Info stealers are just off-the-shelf software that you can acquire in the dark web, and dark web makes it sound like something sinister and it makes it sound like a soundbite from CNN, for example. And it's not even that. It's just a different place. It's a different series of websites. But that's not the point. The economic model behind malware and info stealers are just a fraction of that. It's highly complex, it's highly professional, has lots of people working there at many different levels, has great and very talented coders there writing tools. What you're talking about with the Chrome update, it's the way that Chrome stores their cookies right now, and they are protected when they are on disk, changed in one of the latest versions of Chrome, and now applications can all third-party applications no longer have direct access to those cookies. This affected info stealers because they would steal the cookies from an authenticated session and then they would leak it, as you said, through Telegram channels, and they would be sold there and you could buy the cookies and then you could impersonate the user that has been logged in. And this would happen like instantaneously. It would be stolen the moment that you logged into whatever required your account, and that would be transmitted to Telegram and somebody would purchase it within minutes or seconds and would use it immediately. That's how evolved these things are. It's not like you're just spraying info, you're spraying malware all over the place. Some of these attacks are highly targeted. There's highly specific software developed to do these types of things. And it's like going to the supermarket. You just pick off the shelf components and you use them and you, ta-da, you're a hacker.
Yep.
And this is a fascinating aspect of malware and by fascinating, I mean this in the most morbid way possible.
Right.
It's like going in the highway and seeing a car crash and then slowing down just to see what's happening. And this is the same type of fascination that it might bring to people. But it's an interesting article. It's really fascinating to look at the way that all of this works and is structured, and definitely worth a read if you're into that.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely check out the article. Again, it's in the description. And I believe there's a URL you wanted to mention as well, Chao?
Yes. This is our closing point for today. We at TaxCare, we are running a survey. We're going to create a report, the State of the Enterprise 2025 report. We'll be looking at different things that happened during 2024, trends, and we need to get everybody's opinion. And yeah, if you're willing to take a survey, it's completely anonymous, unless you want to give us your email and be eligible to win a gift at the end. You'll be able to choose what you're applying for. There are different gifts available. This isn't something that's going to have tens of thousands of people submitting, so there's a relatively good chance of actually winning the award. We do give out the awards. Last year, we did reach out to the winners, and we did give them the awards the same as the year before. So this isn't just something that happens and nobody gets the award in the end. It does. The survey is interesting, touches on many aspects of what happened during this past year. The idea is to paint a relatively good and accurate image of the state of the enterprise right now and the trends that might emerge and the technologies that are being used. We will more than likely touch on the report in the coming months as it's released. We'll touch on it here in the podcast. But as you'll see with many other companies also running their reports, in the end, when you aggregate all of the information, it does show the way that the industry is moving and the trends inside of the industry, and that's really useful for everybody.
Really is. Yep. Knowledge is power. So we'll make sure a link to that is in the description. It's not there now for the live audience, but it will be there immediately when it gets posted to the podcast networks in 1 to 2 hours from right now. So
thank you, everybody who joined. As always, it was a pleasure. And until the next one.
See you next time.